Hi, and welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. I'm Amanda Nystrom, the Chief Operating Officer at Command Prompt, a leader in open source excellence since 1997. We hope that you enjoy the podcast today and contact us for your Postgres and full stack needs, including 24/7 support. Find us at 503-667-4564 at commandprompt.com or at sales@commandprompt.com. Enjoy.
Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Our guest today is Mark Porter, the CTO of MongoDB. Mark, introduce yourself.
Well, hey there, it's good to see you. I am indeed Mark Porter, the CTO of MongoDB. I have done a lot of other jobs as well. I'm celebrating my 1 year anniversary at Mongo, but I have been dealing with data since I was about 16 or 17.
Well, that's great. You know, for those that listen, and as you know, Mark, I live in the relational world. My company, Command Prompt, is a big PostgreSQL firm. And having someone like yourself from Mongo is kind of interesting for us because it's a completely different paradigm. I mean, they're both databases, but the ideology and the methodology around them is different. Before we get into a little bit more deep of your history, I'm just kind of curious, what was the shift for you like to go from your Oracle background, your Microsoft SQL background, and so on and so, and PostgreSQL background, to suddenly be with a document database?
You know, I'll go back a little bit for that, but my entire career, I have either used databases at NASA and Caltech, or built them at Oracle and Amazon, or used them at Grab Taxi, which is the Uber of Southeast Asia. And so I'm actually privileged, and I don't use that word lightly, to have seen both sides of the database game, using databases, developing against databases, and developing the databases themselves, and running businesses based on those databases. So for me, it wasn't actually that much of a switch. It was about customer obsession. And customer obsession is delivering to end customers what they want. But also one of the customers I've started focusing on in the last half of my career is developers. And they're one of my customers as well. And, you know, frankly, it's not going to surprise you that I think that MongoDB is actually easier to develop against in a lot of cases than the traditional SQL-based databases. I'm not going to take the relational, non-relational bait as much. We can talk about that if you'd like.
No, I think that I'm more interested in the easier to develop for versus the ideology of, you know, relational versus non-relational. I think they both have their place. I learned a long time ago, being an ideologue doesn't serve anybody's purpose but for dictators. But I am curious about easier to develop for, because, you know, as Command Prompt, we focus mostly, I mean, we do end up with doing some, for example, Amazon Document DB, which is based on Postgres. We end up doing some of that type of work, but we focus mainly on the, you know, the Postgres world, which is clearly a relational. And when I hear easy to develop for, I hear two things. The first thing I hear is we've got excellent APIs, excellent drivers, good documentation, our procedures, functions, methods, abstracts, all that are well thought out. And I think that's easy to develop for. But then there's the other side. And I call this the PHP argument. Now, I'm not talking about the PHP of today. But the PHP, when it first came out, when it was just a CGI binary, you could easily, you load it up in Apache and boom, you're building web apps. Now, the problem with that kind of easy is you get a lot of dumb. And there's a difference between being an appropriate production quality, you know, the prior set of easy and the second set of easy. So what are we referring to here?
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction. So I think that all products should have the first kind of easy. They should be well documented. They should have APIs that do what they say. They should have public roadmaps. And you know, frankly, I mean, I'm not going to hide any secrets here. You know, if I had to choose my favorite relational database, it would indeed be Postgres. And I think you know that from our shared history together, dude. That being said, oh, go on.
Oh, I was going to say, I definitely do, but go ahead.
That yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, Postgres is kind of magical. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are magical about Postgres, like its extensibility model. The members of the community are amazing. It's just, it's the way it has handled forks and lack of forks and things like that. It's just great. But I am indeed talking more about the second kind of ease of use. So when I've been developing small apps against MongoDB and I decide I just want to add something new, I don't have to go to some console and say alter table, add anything. I certainly don't have to go log a ticket with some IT department. I just add a member to my struct, an int or a string or whatever. And it's you know, automatically processed into the system. And so that's one kind of ease. The other kind of ease, which is much more subtle, is that if you actually think about your schema and you put the data you're going to access together and you access either read or write together in the database, which the document model lets you do, you get something which as it scales, it typically doesn't hit some of the scaling cliffs that I've seen with rows and table databases. Now, notice I'm not saying relational because, I mean, MongoDB handles relations just as well as a relational database. But all the data is together in one place often, as opposed to in a rows and tables database where the data might be scattered across many machines on many disk drives just to get one customer and their orders back. So as we see people get started with MongoDB, absolutely that whole, you know, ease of getting going PHP thing is really important. But people also go out there and they use JSON schema enforcement and they use indexes and they use constraints and they use all those things to model their data just as effectively with document databases as they do with row and column databases.
Interesting. You bring up a scaling cliff. Now, anyone in relational databases knows that there's it's easier to scale up than out. The scaling out is the hardest part. And for those that have figured that out, they become wildly successful, even if the scale out is limited. When dealing with the MongoDB, and forgive me, my knowledge of Mongo is probably about 3 years old. And so I want to give an accurate representation. The consultant side of me, the architect side of me, when I walk in and someone is saying, you know, JD, tell us how to build this. I'm not the one that builds it anymore, thank goodness. But they'll say, tell us how to build this. And I'll say something like, okay, so for your integrity store, your data store, you know, you got your PostgreSQL in the background and you're running that with synchronous replication over to these machines. And then here's your disaster recovery that's async, so on and so forth. You know the drill. But then we start talking about caching layers. We start talking about proxy delivery of information. And that's when something like a Cassandra or a MongoDB will come up where we say, well, you know, an easy way to handle this is that your writes, you're going to push all those through any kind of critical write. That's going to get pushed through down to Postgres. But for anything that's, you know, you're building a document, delivering information, you can keep that in Postgres, but then we can push that up to say a Mongo because Mongo is going to handle the horizontal scalability and let's call it caching. We can call it other things, but let's call it caching for speed. The performance delivery to your end user. Do you think that that's still accurate or is, or let me rephrase, of course, that part can be accurate, but what further extension can we expect from MongoDB today?
Well, so back in 2018, or at least with 4.0, I'm not sure of the year, I think it was 2018, we launched full ACID transactions across document types, across collections, across the whole nine yards. So that was a concern. I don't know where your knowledge is. You said 3 years, so that was right on the cusp. So we support full ACID transactions today. And that gives people, when they need it, the ability to get that, you know, that true consistency that databases have offered for a very long time. Now, on the scaling argument, I'm going to come at it a little bit differently. There's no reason to just start with your relational database as small and then only use MongoDB or those other NoSQL solutions when you get large. Start small. You still get ease of development. You still get all of the enforceability that you do or don't want, and you get scaling. Now, I do just want to throw in here because I want to put a plug in. I really dislike it when people say that MongoDB is schemaless or the other NoSQL databases are schemaless. It is just as important to understand your data and understand your schema in MongoDB as in any other database. And anyone who says anything different is just wrong. They're missing the point. We all have to understand our data. And when you understand your data and you understand it in a document model, the system can store and retrieve it more efficiently and your code can be written more efficiently. To just get and put a customer object, I don't have to go and traverse five tables and get and put the eyes of the order or the preferences or anything else. Computers have gotten so much faster and so much better that now we can kind of subsume all that cleverness down into the computer layer. When Claude did his thing in 1970, you know, the computers just weren't that smart. And we had to really, really help the computers. I don't think we have to do it anymore.
That is a really interesting statement. One, I want to applaud you for saying that we must understand our data. You have been in the same world that I'm in, where we're basically, our job is to fix other people's problems. And by far the problem is usually a lack of understanding of what they've done, right? It's like, who gave you this foot gun and then reloaded it? Right. It's just
right. And you and I between us have probably debugged easily 1,000 customer databases where the data wasn't modeled correctly.
Easy. And so Now I'm curious, because so I run into developers all the time that will say, oh man, NoSQL, Mongo, because it's schemaless. It what you just said, don't think of it that way. And it's easy. And you know, they're referring to the get put that you brought up, which I think is fabulous, right? And I actually, one of the projects for Postgres, which is really interesting to me, is the Postgres, which is a RESTful API to Postgres, to kind of abstract out that stuff. But I want you, can you dive down a little bit on this? Let me put this in a way, because I'm in such a traditional realm of data, being relational, I'm dealing with Greenplum, which is based on Postgres. I'm dealing with Aurora, which is based on Postgres, but it's all basically Postgres in some way, shape, or form. The types of people or the types of opinions that I run into are largely the same, right, across the board because of the technology I'm dealing with. Now, you're saying to me something that they say that MongoDB people don't say, which is, MongoDB is saying you need to pay attention to your data. You need to know your JSON constraints. You need to understand what you're doing for MongoDB to be effective, or as effective as it can be. Can you dig down on that a little bit?
Sure. So you or I or anyone else listening to this can stand up an app in a couple hours on MongoDB or on a relational database, whatever, which works, scales to maybe, I don't know, 500,000 rows without any problem. But when you start talking about enterprise apps, I mean, I think you and I just know, you have to understand your data. So I'm not really a fan of people who say the words, like I said, schemaless and all that. But what you want to do is you don't want to have a step function when you go from something small to something big, or something that was just an idea you had to being the featured app on the App Store this week. And so you have to have this system where you can start and you can iterate and iterate quickly and add fields to your tables and add indexes where you need them and have the system like MongoDB does, which actually suggests to get rid of indexes or add indexes, things like that, where the computer's doing things for you. At the same time, there comes a time when either a compliance or a governance or an IT department needs to enforce that schema. And they can do that in a rows and columns database. They can do that in a database which supports, relations and all sorts of other data types like Mongo. There does come in an enterprise app the time to enforce your data model. I mean, otherwise it would just be the Wild West out there for enterprise applications, and that just doesn't work.
Well, so I got to be honest with you, the number of applications I've dealt with, it is the wild, wild west out there.
It is. So look, here's the reality. I was at Oracle from 1988 to 2000. And I dealt with databases, I dealt with video servers, and we built software that was appropriate for that time. And I'm so proud of the work that was done at Oracle, and we can get into that, why it was game-changing, whatever. At the same time, the dimensions have changed. Speed of development, speed of deployment. Developers are expensive now. Machines are expensive, but they're nowhere near as expensive compared to developers as they used to be. And now we need to focus on that. So if you think about Conroy's law, which is, you know, you will ship code that looks like your org, or you think of the Dunbar number, which is the fundamental number of people that all of us can trust. For most humans, it's between 50 and 80. For me, it's like 30 because I'm a tech person. For my wife, it's like 300 because she's so social. The net is you need to build your companies with teams building services on data stores, which obey Conroy's law and which obey Dunbar's number. And that means they move fast, they iterate, and they're decoupled. MongoDB and other modern databases are perfect for that. Now, you can use Postgres for that too, don't get me wrong. I don't mean to say you can't, but when you look at what we've built with MongoDB, with built-in charts, with built-in analytics, we're really, really focusing on those move fast Dunbar level teams that then you tie them all together like Legos into some massive structure that your company ships. So I'm not actually here to slam on relational. I mean, I've worked on relational most of my career. I'm here to say that our way is better, not that the other way is bad, just that our way is better. Does that help?
It does. And now we must disagree.
I knew this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And does the podcast end right here?
Yeah. No, let's stop. Cut. No. This is from experience because we're still in the field, and I don't mean to imply anything negatively, but this is my experience with enterprise apps, and I am not talking about your, you know, $10 million seed funded startup, right? I'm talking about multi-billion dollar companies. I'm not going to mention which ones, but I'm talking about big, big companies doing enterprise level stuff that if it's messed up, if it's broken, real people's lives are affected. And they practice a lot of what you're talking about in terms of the speed of development, the iteration, moving quickly. And then they pay us a ridiculous amount of money to fix all the mistakes they're making. And it's because they're moving fast, iterating quickly, not testing, not stepping back and thinking about, sure, we can, but should we? What's the best way to do this? It's not, those aren't the thoughts. The thoughts are, we must get to point X by Y date to achieve Z goal. And the problem is the Z goal gets reset because they ignored the rest of the variables in the chain, and they end up getting delayed. They end up running five-year-old versions of software because they had some odd dependency, or they didn't slow down enough to upgrade to an LTS version of a library. You know, all these weird things, because what we have, you said developers, and this is very, very, this is again, from my experience, developers don't pay attention to everything else that's required outside of their silo. So if you have a developer and you say, develop this widget, they focus on that widget without any kind of expectation of, well, I have a write cache, a kernel cache, a buffer cache, I have to deal with an operating system. If I'm writing out a 300K size array, that's not a big deal over an iteration of 1,000. But what happens if it's an iteration of 1,000,000? Those types of things. And so I find it, and I'm not saying your way is wrong. Clearly, the way
that I think we actually agree. Keep going, though. I think we actually agree.
Okay. So clearly, your method gets things done. That's not the argument. It's that I find that it gets things done with some sacrifices that don't need to be made, which actually cause people's lives to be a little bit more difficult. Where do you think we agree?
So where I think we agree is that good practices, good engineering can never be skipped. Understanding of the overall system can never be skipped. I sometimes get a little frustrated, and you and I are of a similar age, so I'll just say this. I sometimes wonder if people haven't forgotten that there's a chip down there valiantly trying to execute the instructions coming in on the bus. And I always want any engineer to know the architecture they're working in, all the way from the translation look side buffer, I mean, I'll just say Meltdown Inspector and leave it at that, all the way up to understanding enterprise service bus architecture that their company has decided to use and what the data sovereignty rules are around it. So I think you're dead on. I think we actually agree that there is absolutely no excuse for people not taking the broader view. So that's where I think we agree. Where I'm trying to optimize that is by letting teams have all those guardrails built around them with frameworks, with monitoring, with managed services, with security and all those things, and then innovating as quickly as possible within the guardrails. And that's where I think engineering teams do really, really well.
I would agree. I think we're in agreement, but now you've brought up another interesting point, managed services. Now, we've seen through, obviously through your time at Amazon with RDS, with Aurora, which you helped architect. I believe it was actually Grant McAllister. He's the one that put together the storage engine, correct? For Aurora.
So, I mean, that's a fun little story. So MySQL has a pluggable storage engine, and way, way back in the dawn of prehistory, I'm not sure AWS would want me to say, they decided they needed a new storage engine for MySQL. It ended up being so much more work than they ever thought, and it took years longer, but they came out with this great storage engine, and you can look it up on the internet, and I would advise a lot of you to do so. If you just look up Aurora storage engine, we did a blog about it. And then along comes Postgres, and Postgres is an amazing engine, as you and I are both Postgres fanboys. And we decided Postgres needed some help with its storage engine too, and could benefit from six copies and Quorum and automatic backups and all that other stuff. And so it was actually October of 2014 when Grant and I and a number of other people all in a room, and we decided that we should do this MySQL thing on Postgres too. And it was like a light bulb went off and everyone in the room. And, you know, it took us, I think, 4 or 5 years to launch it, but it was a great thing. In other words, we wanted to put together the systems engineering we had done on the other engine with, frankly, the relational goodness and the engine goodness of Postgres.
Yeah, and believe me, it's been fantastic. I mean, the main problem we run into now with our clients is clients that want Aurora but don't need it, right? When we look at them like, I mean, sure, we'll deploy you on Aurora, but you don't need what it gives you. There are some, and we'll leave their names out, but there are some that do need it and have very much appreciated and enjoyed what Aurora provides. But one of the things that I find interesting through those types of developments, and although some in the community may not agree with this, and it's not just Amazon, it's also Microsoft and it's Google and it's a few other firms out there. But through their innovation with PostgreSQL, the community is driving new innovation. One of the things about the PostgreSQL community is that obviously it has limited development resources. It's fully open source, but it also takes a little bit of a it's good enough mentality. And what happens is that when you have these larger organizations, innovating and making the core of Postgres better, and plus trying to contribute back to the community, and the community being the community, it drives the community to move forward at adding at least base level features. For example, PostgreSQL now has pluggable storage engines that you can code against to build out your own storage engine. But I want to come back around to managed services a little bit, because this kind of plays into, and hear me out, open source, MongoDB, as I understand, is no longer open source. I have no problem with that decision. You and I have talked about it in the past. As far as I'm concerned, MongoDB's code is MongoDB's code. They can do with it whatever they want. And I do understand the business reason as to why that decision was made. So I don't think we need to go into that unless you'd like to elaborate on it, which I fully understand. But around managed services and the cloud, MongoDB has its own cloud, yes?
Yeah, so MongoDB has our cloud called Atlas, which has a whole bunch of stuff in it. It has analytics, search, mobile. It also has that MongoDB managed database in there as well. It's put all together into one thing. And I will definitely say, just on the adoption of managed services, 5 years after we launched Atlas, which was last month, 5 year anniversary, it is now 51% of our business. And we're very excited about that.
That's fantastic. It's a great place to be. As you know, Command Prompt does managed services as well, but we do it differently in that what we do is we take over teams, right? Where we become a client's managed service for their managed services. So they don't need to hire DBAs. They don't need to hire sysadmins or whatever, or even developers for that matter, if that's the type of level that they want. But my concern, or the question that I have, it's not really a concern. What about lock-in? Okay, I invest, and this doesn't apply just to Mongo. This applies to Timescale. This applies to Aurora, the whole bit. And back in the day, you know, you've been with Oracle. You've used databases at News Corp. You obviously helped build our Amazon RDS and Aurora. So we've been around a while. We remember the days of, say, Clipper, DBase 3, the old Oracles. We remember those, you know, Fox Pro. And it used to be, especially the main argument for open source for, let's say, not from infancy, but we'll say late 90s to about 2010. The main argument was no lock-in, vendor free. You can see the code. I've always found the see the code thing kind of silly because most people that use it don't even know what the code is saying. But you know, it's transparent and you could pay anybody you want to either support it or improve it. And you never have to actually worry about end of life as long as you're willing to pay to support it yourself. But now society has came back around. As I recall, it wasn't yourself, but it was, I can't remember his name, but we were at a Postgres conference and it was a gentleman from Redmonk. And Redmonk came up and gave a keynote at our conference. And he was talking about, it boils down to simplicity is the key now. The easier you make life for people, the more money you're going to make, basically. And we have found that to be true in our market because we take a lot of the pain of having white glove, platinum level people taking care of your stuff out of you having to take care of it. So I certainly understand, you know, being able to go to an executive and say, look, you don't need to worry about this. This is how much it's going to cost, approve it or not. They approve it. They don't have to worry about it. We make it happen. So that makes sense from the cloud perspective. But one of the worries I have as an open source advocate is that I put energy as a company into, say, an application, and that application makes use of all the APIs, all the features, all the knobs, and everything that MongoDB provides me. And I love MongoDB. And again, this could be any of the other providers too. It's just that we're speaking with MongoDB. But we love MongoDB. We're making money. MongoDB is making money. Everybody's happy. But then, 5 years later, MongoDB gets acquired. Maybe MongoDB doesn't get acquired. Maybe a downturn in the economy happens. It causes them to reevaluate their objectives and they shift to a different direction and they put an eight month notice on supportability for the last enterprise version of their cloud software. And what I'm alluding to here is what Red Hat did with CentOS, but it applies in this realm because we've kind of locked ourselves in. How do we protect our customers? And I do say our because I'm in the same industry. How does MongoDB protect its customers? And how does Command Prompt protect their customers against that kind of shift or that kind of lock-in? How do we keep it productive?
So So, I mean, you said so much there. So the first thing I want to say is one of the beauties of a managed service is that someone can start from zero and go to huge without doing anything. We just launched serverless 2 weeks ago, and our serverless is a different kind of serverless than the serverless you might be familiar with Postgres and Aurora, and we can get into that. Our serverless is literally, you don't have to, there's no server hidden in the background. It's actually a multi-tenant fleet. So that's kind of fun. So you can go from zero to huge. Now, why did I mention that? Because one kind of lock-in is that you're locked into the minimum or maximum capacity of your service provider. So we try to fight that, and we try to make sure that we offer zero to huge very easily. But now you bring up this incredible topic, which I'm very passionate about. We have had 80 million downloads, I believe, in the last 12 months, and only 175 million downloads, I think, in the entire 13-year history of our company. And I'm gonna call issue to the fact, and we know each other, so we can do this, dude, which is I'm gonna call issue to the fact that we have a vibrant open community around MongoDB. And anyone can come talk to me about that after the podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Mark Loves Tech. And I'm gonna tell you right now, we have this vibrant community that is open and enthusiastic and loves what we do. We are standards-based with JSON schema, standards-based with JSON, standards-based with our openness of what we do. Now, why does this matter? Because there's two kinds of lock-in. One kind of lock-in is your code and the code you write. And then Susie leaves the company and Susie didn't take good notes on the code she wrote. And the other kind of lock-in is your management framework. And we talked about this at RDS all the time. Sure, if you write scripts around RDS and then you decide not to use RDS or Atlas moving forward, sure, you have to go write some scripts differently, but you're not really locked in. The real kind of lock-in you experience is your code. And so I think that Postgres doesn't really have lock-in because people can choose to use the community version. MongoDB doesn't have lock-in because people can choose to use the community version. And then we do things like make our drivers open source as well. And so we're really, really trying to be, and I'm going to say this very carefully, JD, a profitable, healthy company that is as open as we can possibly be in every way. We love openness. We also love the fact that us being a healthy company lets us innovate for all those people who use our software. And I know Postgres goes through this same drama in their meetings of how do we produce the best possible software and be as open and welcoming as possible.
Well, you brought up an interesting point there, which is the openness. And, openness and open source are different things. And we agree on that. I don't think we need to go into that. In a lot of ways, it feels kind of like you're using the Microsoft model, in that Microsoft for a long time, and still does, has a huge community. And a lot of people in the open source world would say, well, they don't have community. They have vendors, they have partners, they have customers, they don't have community. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. With Postgres Conference, we ran into the same thing where the quote unquote traditional community of PostgresQL.org would look at Postgres Conference and say, that's not community because we were friendly to business, because we consider business as partners, and we were essentially a professional community. We were all about the people that are using Postgres to make their living or run their business or something like that. So when you say your drivers are open source, I just want to be clear. They literally are released under a license that is qualified.
Yeah, they're Apache. Our drivers are Apache.
Good for you. That is actually an excellent, excellent
I don't ever want a developer to feel trapped by anything I do. Now, obviously I have to innovate. I have to do stuff. So, sometimes it's nuanced, don't get me wrong, but I want a developer to choose us every day because they want to. And we listen to our community more than any other company I've ever been at. I have a huge DevRel team. Even though I'm a small company, our DevRel developer relations team rivals larger companies that are 10 to 20 times our size in size and energy because we listen to our developers. And so at every junction, when we sit together and do product planning, we fight lock-in, we fight developer fear of anything we do. you know, I just want to let you know that's our culture. And I'm really excited about that. Now, part of it is because our main customer is actually a developer, not a business unit owner, not a CTO. Obviously, we have to sell to those people. It keeps us kind of our North Star of delighting developers is always kept front and center.
Okay, so I would agree. I would reiterate my statement that it's very much similar to the old Microsoft model where, you know, not quite as aggressive, not with Steve Ballmer on stage jumping up and down saying developers, 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 but by focusing on the people that are going to build the applications on Mongo, you provide a successful model, not only for Mongo, but also for those developers and the companies that they're supporting.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you because the Microsoft model, I know what you're saying. Their obsession with developers and Visual Code and Visual Studio, I mean, and adopting Linux. Wow, those guys have come a long ways. But you want to run SQL Server. Guess whose permission you still need? You want to run MongoDB, you don't need my permission. And so there is a fundamental difference that I think is important for a corporation because there are very few decisions as important as the persistence software you choose.
Interesting. Okay, I would buy into that. So you're right. I can just download MongoDB and I can install it or, God forbid, run Docker. And you know, boom.
I think you just started another podcast there, by the way.
Yeah. I'm not even going to go down that road. You're right. I can load it up on a server and start using it. I don't need your permission as long as I adhere to the license, which I think it's about as liberal as it can be, except I can't create a cloud managed service, right? Is that what I can't do with it? Other than that,
yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. All right, so we kind of actually got out of the our little outline here, but I do want to get back to you personally. I mean, obviously the personality of MongoDB is clearly positive. The market itself, your financials have shown to be true that the migration away from quote unquote pure open source certainly did not hurt MongoDB. And as far as I can tell, it certainly didn't hurt your reputation. In fact, those in the know actually kind of gave you a nod and understanding of why it had to happen. And you've been successful with it and you continue to grow. In fact, one of your marketing folks, Cesar Rojas, I actually know him personally as well. And he came, I don't know if you know this, but he came, I can't remember the company he was with in between, but he was at Pivotal/Greenplum before they became VMware again. He's now with Mongo and he speaks, you guys have turned him around. He is 100% drinking the vitamin filled Kool-Aid. So I think that's awesome.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah, it really speaks to your culture, right? It's certainly, PostgreSQL has always had the challenge that there's always been companies out there building for it. We've got them in Russia, we've got them in Japan, China, United States, but no one has ever become a player by themselves until Amazon that was big enough to make it kind of a standard thing. It's no longer abnormal to run into someone who wants to run Postgres.
So I guess I did this to myself.
Yeah, you really did. hey, so we've got some questions for you that we haven't touched on. What is it about technical puzzles that excites you?
So I've always loved the delight of that moment when your mind is blank. I'm studying chess puzzles right now, and I have a book of 100 chess puzzles. And I got to tell you, I can stare at that 8x8 board for hours before coming up with, oh, just move the bishop there. And I just love puzzles, and I love that feeling of cleverness. And the other thing I like, and this is particularly true in software, it doesn't appear to be true in piano or chess. But you build on each thing. So as you solve one puzzle, like you learn how to do a sort, or as you solve another puzzle, which is you learn how to build a storage system, these things build. And I just love that. And I always have. I've always gotten that, I don't know, what is it, dopamine rush or something from that concept of just solving something.
Interesting. I don't play piano. My children do. And I played chess off and on my entire life. And I enjoy chess, but I have a problem. And then I can often see the end game. I can't often see how to get there.
Well, then you and I would make a perfect match.
maybe our next enterprise gig when we're both entirely too old to be doing this. Okay. So now we have to get to, you know, what everybody talks about. And it's coming back around, and that's COVID. Now, I don't want to talk about COVID as a pandemic specifically, but I do want to discuss remote work. Now, we are in a blessed world, and when I say we, I'm talking about the people in our industry, and that usually we don't actually have to go into an office to conduct our work. I mean, Command Prompt has existed since 1997. We've been fully remote since I think 04. We have no central office. There is nobody, you can't come bang on a door. And we've been quite successful with that. There's a lot of larger companies, and this doesn't really necessarily apply to Mongo, although I would be interested in what your remote work policy is. There's a lot of companies in our industry that are actually not embracing remote work. And my question to you as a C-level executive, and is this fear of remote work, this you're coming back to the office, the pandemic was the exception to the rule. Is this because, well, and I'll give you a real quick anecdotal story. I had a boss one time when I was very, very young, who got very stressed out. And this was before you could go to the park and work over your phone. And I said, hey man, why don't you just take your laptop, go to the park, you know, work out, you know, start chopping through the task list. And he looked me dead in the face. And he said, I do not pay X amount of dollars for this office to go to a park and work. Well, that guy's now in cannabis. He's not in the IT industry at all, but it strikes me that is it these larger companies have made such an investment in their commercial infrastructure, meaning their offices, their chairs, their kitchens, their chefs, all this stuff. Or is it a fear of not being able to have control is maybe the wrong word, because I don't want to say that these companies are like trying to control their employees, but certainly a feeling that their employees aren't going to be as productive or aren't going to be as loyal or something like that. What are your thoughts as a C-level executive of a public company of that type of problem?
I have some pretty strong thoughts.
Please.
In the knowledge industry and in the innovation industry, which we are indeed privileged to be in. I just want to make it very clear that, like you said, we are lucky and privileged to have been less affected by COVID than so many billions of people around the world. Look, if you don't trust your people, then either there's something wrong with you or something wrong with them, or there's something you guys need to talk about. So that is a foundational principle of trust. Second, I subscribe to the idea of giving people context with candor, and then they want to be held accountable. Now, when you hide things from them, you create a dynamic with your employees that they're like, oh, I guess it's us versus the man versus the boss, if you know that old meme. I don't believe in that. I believe that if you give employees the information they need and the empowerment and the ability to do experiments. Now, a lot of people say stuff like, oh, let them fail. You know, no one's going to plan to fail. But if you give them the freedom to do experiments, some of those experiments are going to have suboptimal results. Hint, that's a failure. Okay. Now, I believe that people should be able to work wherever, whenever, and however they want in this knowledge industry. I will tell you that people who are earlier in their careers often need to take a while to figure out what that is, and we can all help them with coaching and all that. But I believe that you know, I tell my directs, I don't need to know where you are, when you are, whatever. What I need to know is if you need help from me in terms of information, in terms of resources, in terms of clarity or decisions. That's it. So that's a foundational principle about how I believe. Now, how does that relate to COVID and MongoDB? We have, I am proud to say that we have one of the best remote or flexible working models that I think of any company as I listen to all these other companies. You can either choose to be in office 3 or more days a week. You get your own assigned desk. You can be flexible, which is you're in office 1 to 2 days a week, or you can be fully remote, which is you come into the office, whatever office you want, whenever you want. We let our employees and our managers and our teams pick those with no top-down percentages or guidelines or anything. And what we're finding is that this has caused people to be happy, to be productive, and to be more loyal to MongoDB and more engaged. Our engagement scores, and this is going to blow you away, dude, our engagement scores have gone up during COVID, not down. We use a tool called CultureAmp, and our engagement scores have gone up. And the reason why is because we have come to COVID because of my boss, Dave, and our chief people officer, Harsha, are so enlightened about empowering people that they've just made all these amazing choices. And so I'm excited about this. And frankly, I believe that the day of the cubicle farm is hopefully numbered. And if it took this to do it, then so be it. Will be one benefit out of this entire worldwide disaster that we've been faced with.
I would agree with you. I mean, you know, as I said, we've been command prompts and remote for a long time. It's a little bit easier for us because we're smaller, right? We're, you know, but the interesting thing about the pandemic is the economic shift, which is where I was kind of going with this, is that now we have a lot of individuals who, you know, they don't want to go back to their own jobs. Or they transitioned into jobs that are somehow either in our field or related to our field. I mean, everything's related to our field at this point. And it's changing the dynamic of how people conduct business. And we'll have to, only time will tell if this is a positive thing, of course, but we'll see. So moving on, I gotta bring this up just because you and I together we have built an experience over this. And I must Dance Revolution, brother. Dance Dance Revolution. Do you remember Dance Dance Revolution?
That's the game where you have the four arrows and stuff, right?
Yes.
I love that game. I actually play that game with my kids now that GameWorks is back open. We actually found all of our old GameWorks cards and we're actually going to go and play that. I love that.
So you may not remember this, but it was, oh man, I think it was either 2016 or 2017. I don't remember, but I was up on stage at the Postgres conference. And I was talking about the cocktail evening, which was the big party that we always hold. And I called you out directly in front of everybody to play Dance Dance Revolution. Now, the funny thing about this is that I was very confident in my ability to wipe the floor with a high-level Amazon employee in Dance Dance Revolution. And then Mark stands next to me. And I don't remember the exact words that you said, but it was something to the effect of, I have daughters too. And we played that for 20, 30 minutes and were just sweating and hot and exhausted, just going after each other to, well, not in their prime, but not yet old men. On Dance Dance Revolution, of all things. Do you remember this?
I do now that you say it, and I have gotten a lot better since then because a couple of my kids love challenging me on it. Now we did take a pause because of the pandemic, but we are looking to get back to it. In fact, it just came up this week.
Excellent.
So,
Excellent. My kids are mostly grown, so I don't actually get to enjoy it as much anymore. But I remember that fondly because I remember it was one of those what have I done to myself moments, because normally when I would play against other community members, they had, like, I played against Bruce Momchen at one point, and, you know, he had no idea what we were doing. But for you to stand there and be like, you're going down, brother. And it was just like, you know, I should think about who I challenge in the future, you know? Okay. So we are, we're cruising down the timeline here, and you're a very busy gentleman, and I appreciate that. We are aware of your time. I would like to talk about, this is kind of a good roll off from the DDR. You've got a position on LinkedIn as volunteer, technically deep father of five. What is, you know, as a father myself, I like to talk to other fathers, especially those who are particularly successful. And that, you know, my two youngest, although I only have one that's under 18 now, are girls. And as a father, there's a certain bond that develops there that's different than the bond, not better or worse, but different than the bond you have with sons. And I just wanted to reach out to you as a father, and I want to get your perspective on what's it like being a father, especially if so many children. I only have three myself, and you're five. So congratulations on that, by the way. But what are your, how is that for you?
Look, I mean, we could do another podcast on parenting. I will tell you one thing. I knew more about parenting the year before I had my first child than I do today. Because you're so confident in your beliefs. And then you eventually realize that you're going to have five children. For me, they're different. They need you to be a different father, just like your employees need you to be a different boss for everyone. And so the voluntarily, technically deep father of five was a way of capturing that I worked with each child to find something that we were both excited about, because it couldn't just be something they were excited about and I wasn't excited about, because that was inauthentic. And while my children are actually quite wide in their interests, I'm quite narrow. So I had to find areas of technical depth with them. Like with one of my sons, it was programming. With my daughter, it was heat, how insulation works. We did some projects. With one of my sons, it was AI. And so I had to find ways to bond with them, but it all comes back to one thing. I want my children to experience what it's like to have that aha moment. I want my employees to have that experience of what it's like of being just awesome at something. Because I think that once you get that feeling as a child or as an employee or in any part of your life, it possibly lights a spark that makes you want more of it. And it can change the direction of your life, either personally or professionally, or maybe, you know, I fell in love with my wife at first sight. It took her 2 years, let's be really clear, but I fell in love with her at first sight. And so that little spark is what I try to light in employees, in my kids, and in my romantic relationships as well. And that, you know, that's what that's all about.
Well, one, I'd like to applaud you with sticking with it so that she could fall in love with you after 2 years. That's a lot of men wouldn't have that gumption or energy. Is there, you know, out of five children, there's got to be, and I know that you love every one of them the same and differently all at the same time. Is there one challenge that you were presented that stretched you to allow yourself to lead them to that aha moment?
Yeah, I will say one thing. They will be listening to this podcast. They often troll me on Reddit and on LinkedIn and places like that, either under assumed identities or under their real identity. So that's kind of fun. I will say that the largest challenge I had in my, I had two. Can I have two?
Please.
So thing one was the kids were single digit ages and my wife comes to me and she says, "You're losing our kids." And I said, "Why?" And she goes, "You're being the same dad to all five of them." She said, "You think there's a right dad. You got to realize all five of them need a different dad." And that was really, you know, got me pretty tight. The other thing that I've really learned is that once you find their spark, is to change yourself to be that person with them. And so, for example, one of my kids is learning to be a pilot. And so I've decided to learn enough about being a pilot to support him in that role, because all the kids really want is they want to be validated. And that's so hard when, I mean, you're successful, I'm successful, a lot of people listening to this are successful. You kind of got to step back and realize that I don't know the first thing about flying a plane. And so maybe when I talk to my kid who's learning piloting, I have to kind of be stupid for the first couple months in order to validate his interest. And you asked for hard things. Those were two hard things for me.
Okay. So what I would like to say is, first, I would like to applaud you as being a husband who understands that you learn from your wife. There are many husbands that do not understand that you learn from your wife. And that is awesome. The second one, which I think is great, I just to share a little bit here, one of mine just recently happened in that my youngest, Annabelle, earned the right to be a beekeeper. I have no interest in bees. I do now because my daughter does. But we have two hives. We will be able to extract honey next year. And she's a full-on beekeeper in a beekeeper community and the whole bit. And that was a challenge for me because, like you, my sparks are caused narrowly. Unless you want to argue with me about something, in which case we can go on for days. But in terms of what my actual interests are, and when she came to me and said, "Dad, I want to be a beekeeper," I mean, it was kind of like, where in the world did that come from? I definitely want to applaud you for that. We are at the tail end here, but I did want to give you an opportunity to, we've talked a lot about manga, we've talked a lot about data. You've been a world traveler, literally hundreds of thousands of miles. The pandemic has allowed you to travel less, which means you're around for your family more, which is awesome. But I wanted to give you an opportunity. Is there anything that you wanted to continue to share either personally or professionally that you might think is insightful, or at least give something people to think about?
Yeah. So on that travel thing. So yes, I've traveled a lot for large parts of my career. You know what? Your wife and kids don't actually want an amount of time. They want a quality of time. And so when I'm here during the pandemic, I'm sitting in my office with the door closed. I'm not sure I'm actually much more present than I was at AWS 10 miles away in the Amazon buildings or when I was in Singapore. I think it's all about being present. And so people ask me, they say, what was the one thing you would tell yourself when you were 25? And the one thing that I would tell myself is pay attention to the human skills. Pay attention to getting along with people. Pay attention to listening. This is so hard for me. I mean, God, I just want to sit in front of a computer and program, right? And as I'm now an executive, as I deal with people and their cats and their aspirations and their whatevers, it just has come so clear to me that if I had learned to listen to people 15 to 20 years earlier in my career, I would have been happier. God forbid they would have been happier, and I probably would have been more successful.
That is brilliantly insightful. I agree with you 100%. With that, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. We've been talking with Mark Porter, the CTO of MongoDB. Mark, thank you very much for being on, and we hope to have you on again in the future.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me. And by the way, you and I go back so far that this is just the middle of the road. It's not the beginning or the end. So I'm thrilled to be with you on that road.
I appreciate that very much.
This podcast is hosted by JD, Command Prompt founder and Postgres conference chair, and is produced by me, Lindsay Hooper, Director of Events at Command Prompt, Inc. Command Prompt provides Postgres support, professional services, custom development, and community leadership. Since 1997, we've focused on providing just excellent service, custom tailored to your organization's needs. We'll see you soon, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be right back.